Ms. Shin.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Shannon Shin, and I represent the appellant, Deshaun McNary, in this matter. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. Your Honors, this Court should order the Court below to grant Mr. McNary's petition for habeas corpus for several reasons. Namely, his trial and appellate counsel both provided him with ineffective assistance of counsel. First, Your Honors, trial counsel's failure to investigate the custodial issue was unreasonable in light of the undisputed facts. It is undisputed that Mr. McNary gave an incriminating statement to Officer Hardesty. It is undisputed that Officer Hardesty did not first issue a Miranda warning prior to listing that statement. It is undisputed that counsel was not present at that interrogation. Furthermore, it is undisputed that Mr. McNary was handcuffed to his hospital bed and escorted by a police officer at the hospital that evening. These facts alone would have caused any reasonably competent attorney, Your Honors, to conduct a basic investigation, particularly into whether this was a custodial interrogation that warranted the safeguards articulated in Miranda v. Arizona. Your Honors, we're not arguing or faulting trial counsel for failing to investigate every minute detail, nor are we faulting him for failing to hire expensive experts and conduct scientific tests. What we are arguing, Your Honors, is that trial counsel had a constitutional duty to conduct a basic investigation and that he failed to do so. Simply, he failed to conduct a basic investigation and then later at the suppression hearing inexplicably conceded the issue, leaving the trial court with no choice but to deny his motion to suppress. Your Honors, this is not the type of effective assistance guaranteed by the Sixth Amendment. Mr. McNary was then prejudiced, Your Honors, because the motion to suppress, there was more than a reasonable probability that would have been granted. There was plenty of directly relevant evidence as to whether he was or was not in custody. In particular, just these two facts alone, first, that he was handcuffed to the bed at the time of the interrogation, second, that Officer Hardesty admitted not giving the Miranda statement, those two facts alone would have supported granting that motion. He was further prejudiced.
The state appellate court said that even if the evidence of being handcuffed to the bed, that wouldn't have changed the outcome of the suppression
hearing. Well, Your Honor, I think that's one of the direct factors that the Supreme Court has identified, and this court in following that precedent, that restraint on physical movement is certainly a factor to consider. And here, where he was not only handcuffed to bed, but where he was also accompanied by a police escort, thus indicating his inability to have free movement, I think those are very important factors that, had trial counsel investigated the issue, he would have recognized them, he would have raised them, and the standard calls for more than a reasonable probability, and I think here that is certainly met, Your Honors. He was further prejudiced at trial when that statement was admitted to the court. Officer Hardesty testified that Mr. McNary said, quote, "I seen the man standing in the middle of the street. I beeped my horn. He did not move. I kept going." Here, where the primary issue is whether he had the knowledge and or intent necessary to be convicted of first-degree murder, it's important to note that Officer Hardesty's statement is the only statement in the record speaking to any form of intent or knowledge as to the vehicle and the passengers which he struck at 63rd and Ashland. Therefore, without that statement, the jury would not have been able to convict him of first-degree murder. Second issue, Your Honors, appellate counsel was ineffective by failing to appeal the trial court's unreasonable refusal to give a jury instruction. Mr. McNary's only defense in this matter was voluntary intoxication, which would have negated the mental state necessary for a first-degree murder conviction. In Illinois, if there is even slight evidence to support an affirmative defense, the court must issue it. Here, both Mr. McNary and the state presented not just slight evidence, but significant evidence of his extreme intoxication and his inability to form the requisite intent. For 3 days leading into the accident, Mr. McNary was binge drinking. On the day leading into the accident, he had no less than 9 beers, 2 liters of cognac, and several shots, most of that in the evening leading into the accident. Furthermore, the state's own expert testified that Mr. McNary's blood alcohol concentration 3 hours after the accident was 0.22, nearly 3 times the legal limit. Also, there's nothing in the record to indicate that Mr. McNary either saw nor knew of the vehicle or the passengers in the vehicle that he struck at 63rd and Ashland, definitely speaking to whether or not he could have had the knowledge necessary or the intent. Your Honor, despite the fact that Mr. McNary presented a defense wholly premised upon voluntary intoxication, and despite the fact that the state and Mr. McNary presented evidence certainly more than slight evidence to support that, the trial court refused to issue the instruction. This directly contravened state law requiring the court to...
Counsel, don't you have a problem? The Supreme Court keeps saying you can't use 2254 to review a state court's decisions on matters of state law. And the state court did say pretty clearly that the trial judge acted appropriately under state law.
Your Honor, I think what we're referring to here is what the federal court may or may not review in terms of state law. Here, there's a distinction.
The Supreme Court keeps saying nothing.
Well,
you want to distinguish application and interpretation, which, A, I find incoherent, and, B, doesn't respond to anything in the Supreme Court's decisions. 2254 says a person in custody in violation of federal law can get relief. A person in custody in violation of state law can't get relief, not under 2254.
Well, Your Honor, he is there in violation of federal law in the sense that he received ineffective assistance of counsel.
No, he didn't receive ineffective assistance of counsel because the state court found that the trial judge had followed state law. You don't have any right on appeal to have a lawyer try to mislead or get the court to make incorrect decisions. Actually, the Supreme Court held that as a matter of federal ineffective assistance law. Held that in an Eighth Circuit case where a panel of the Eighth Circuit for some time went off base, and before that panel got reversed en banc, a lawyer failed to take advantage of the panel's decision. And the Supreme Court said that was no problem under the Sixth Amendment. No one has a right to the incorrect application of law.
Well, Your Honor, it's not merely just an incorrect application, but this incorrect application should have been noticed by appellate counsel. What we're doing here is not challenging the state court's
application. The state court has told us that this was all done quite properly.
But, Your Honor, we're not challenging that the state court had a particular interpretation route. What we're saying here is that appellate counsel provided deficient performance by failing to recognize an issue that was significant, it was obvious, and it was also raised for appeal, Your Honor, and there was more than slight evidence to support that. Not only was he drinking, not only was all there this evidence to support that he was extremely intoxicated, Your Honors, but ultimately the judge usurped the jury's fact-finding determination duty by determining on his own that he did not present enough evidence. The fact of the matter is this court reviews state law applications regularly, and this is a case where that would be similar, where the state law was applied incorrectly, and as a result, Mr. McNary suffered an injustice under the Sixth Amendment because he received ineffective counsel on what was a very, very winnable and strong issue, Your Honors. Ultimately, Mr. McNary was prejudiced by the failure of not just one, Your Honors, but two attorneys. In other words, he received doubly deficient assistance of counsel, which resulted in him receiving a natural life sentence with no possibility of parole. Here, but for trial counsel's failure to investigate the custody issue and but for appellate counsel's failure to appeal the voluntary intoxication issue, Mr. McNary would be a free man today, Your Honors. For these reasons, we ask that you order the district court below to grant his writ of habeas corpus. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Shin. Mr. Levin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Eric Levin on behalf of the respondent appellee, Warden Hardy. I'd like to just make a few brief points and answer any questions the court might have. First, I think it's important just to stress that both of petitioner's ineffective assistance claims here were rejected on the merits in state court. Under the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, therefore, the petitioner must show not merely that the state appellate court's decisions were wrong, but that they were either contrary to or objectively unreasonable applications of clearly established federal law. Petitioner has essentially, I think, conceded that the state court's decisions were not contrary to federal law. The state court applied Strickland to both of his claims, and with respect to the first claim involving the in-custody requirement, the court properly applied the Supreme Court's decisions on that body of law. The only issue then is whether or not the state appellate court's decision was somehow so objectively unreasonable that no fair-minded jurist could agree with it. With that background, it's important to note here that the state appellate court found, on the record that was before it, that there was no reason for counsel to know, nor should he have known, that Carla had this alleged information about the circumstances surrounding the interrogation. The only thing on the record with respect to this issue is counsel's statement on the record as an officer of the court that he interviewed the members of the family before the suppression hearing, yet didn't find out this information until afterwards. 2254E1 says that the state court's finding determinations of a factual issue are presumed correct on federal habeas review unless there's clear and convincing evidence to rebut them, and petitioner has pointed to no such evidence. Likewise, 2254D2 says that if a state court decides an issue on the merits, habeas relief is prohibited unless that decision was based on an unreasonable determination of the facts in light of the evidence presented. And petitioner has made no showing with respect to that either. Essentially, however, this...
The state court, as I asked your opponent about, it said that if Carla had testimony had been there and they had the testimony about being handcuffed to the bed, that wouldn't change the result. Do you think that's reasonable?
In light of the record that was in front of the state court, I do. And I say that because there were inherent credibility problems with the story Carla told in her proffer. It simply just wasn't possible for her to have been at the hospital at the time she claimed to have been there. And the timing was critical here because if she got to the hospital after 3:50 a.m., which is far more likely, then of course she would have seen the petitioner handcuffed to the hospital bed because after he spoke with Officer Hardesty at 3:50 a.m., he was then placed under arrest. So I do think, I will say that I don't think it can be said that it was outside the bounds of reasonableness for the state appellate court to find that even had Carla given this testimony at the suppression hearing, there's no reasonable probability that there would have been a different result. More importantly, however, there's really no case to be made that there's not a reasonable probability that the result of the trial wouldn't have been different. The petitioner made an even more incriminating statement to Officer Patak. And I think it's important to point out here that the statement to Hardesty focused on what the petitioner knew before he hit the pedestrian. He said, I saw the person in the street, I beat my horn, and I kept going. But with respect to his actions afterwards, which is what's important for the charges of murder stemming from the deaths of the people in the car, what matters is what he knew after he hit the pedestrians. And that is what he tells Officer Patak. He told Officer Patak that he knew he had hit the pedestrian, knew he was drunk, and yet kept driving because he knew the police were chasing him for having hit the pedestrian. It's that statement, as well as his testimony at trial, that he knew he was drunk, that he knew he had hit something, and that he nevertheless kept driving. It's those statements that form the basis of the murder charge that allowed the state to prove that the defendant knew that his actions after striking the pedestrians created a strong probability of death or great bodily harm. So even if the statement to Officer Hardesty is thrown out, there's simply no reasonable probability that the jury wouldn't have nevertheless convicted him of first-degree murder. If there are no further questions either on this first issue or on the second issue, I would rest on our briefs on that second issue, and I would ask the court to affirm the district court's judgment denying habeas relief.
Thank you, Mr. Levin. Anything further, Ms. Shin?
Your Honor, on the issue of Carla McNary's timing as to her testimony, what counsel here is referring to is that she said that at 1 something she heard of the accident, and then it took her 15 or 20 minutes to the hospital, and then almost 2 or around 2 something she arrived at the hospital, and that she saw her brother handcuffed to the bed, and I quote, at 2 something, and that there was someone there accompanying him. Your Honors, the difference here between saying 2 something and even if we were to assume the worst case scenario, it would be 2:30 something, it would even still come more than an hour and a half or about an hour and a half prior to the testimony. Therefore, Your Honors, I just don't see how the credibility here could be at issue when there's nothing to indicate that she had any basis for doing so. She was merely setting the record for appeal purposes. Furthermore, Your Honors, there is a very big distinction, as State Counsel acknowledges, between the testimony given to Officer Petock and the testimony given to Officer Hardesty. It is really essential here that we look to the intent and the knowledge that Mr. McNary had when he was driving his vehicle that night. I think it's clear that he was extremely intoxicated, so the question is, what was he aware of? What did he know? And the State has to show that there was a, quote, strong probability of death or great bodily harm versus, for aggravated reckless homicide, quote, likely to cause death or great bodily harm. Your Honors, he had no intention to kill these people. He simply drove, and in so doing, he created a likelihood of doing so. There was no great or strong probability in his mind because he was too intoxicated to create that intent. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much, Counsel. And, Ms. Chin, the Court appreciates your willingness and that of your law firm to accept the appointment in this case and the assistance you've been to the Court as well as your client.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.